Good morning, everybody, and a big welcome to This Is Your Racing Life. A guest this morning is Andrew Rule, who's a very famous journalist here in Australia, particularly writing about crime and the Underbelly series. But he's also got a very strong interest into horse racing. Andrew, thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Brian. One of the legends of my younger days is growing up listening to you call the races.
I've been around for a while. Tell me about, first of all, you've had, what, just on 40 years in newspapers and media.
I have. I started in sale at the Gippsland Times in 1975 as a 17-year-old boy. I later went to university, but I resumed at the Age newspaper in 1979. So the combined total is bang on 40 years.
So going back 1975, you'd be doing everything when you started out in a country paper.
I did country papers in those days. There was an editor, an A-grade, who was a former Women's Weekly lady. I thought she was very old. She was about 36. There was a B-grade called Colin Coomber, who had a purple Cortina. And there was me, the boy. And I'd be filing photographs. The boss used to go crook because I'd want to write things longhand instead of typing. Taught myself to type on the old manual typewriters, very roughly. Haven't improved much. And you did everything. We did the councils, we did the courts. There were four local councils, I think. There was the local magistrates' court. We did all that local stuff, sport. On Sundays, sometimes I'd come in and sub the sport, lay it out for the Monday paper. It was an all-round adventure.
The name Rule in racing, particularly through Gippsland, is a strong one and has been there for as long as I can remember. Tell us about the background there.
Well, I think it goes back to my great-grandfather, Jack Rule, who was, from what I gather, he was a gambler, always. He was a bloke that was married two or three times. He had racing ponies, as a lot of them did. The Rules were very big on racing ponies in those days, in the Squizzy Taylor era and so on. And I think he used to have fighting cocks. He had a pair of golden spurs he'd won in fighting cocks. I never knew him, but he died before I was born. But he did use a particular set of colours, which is royal blue, pale blue sleeves and cap, which I still have. I've registered those colours and I still have them, and I'll be passing them on to my kids and or my cousin's son, Jacob, who now rides. He's keen to have them.
Now, Jacob is doing well. He's carrying the family tradition on, isn't he?
He is. He's a very good horseman. He's probably, like a lot of them now, he's probably a bit heavy, but he's a very fine horseman. Some jockeys are good horsemen and some are just good race riders, but I think he's more the good horseman. I've heard people like Robert Smurden say what a good man he is with a young horse or a rough horse or a barrier rogue. But of course he grew up, you know, literally grew up on horses. His mother Jane rode, I think she rode, might have ridden a Bensdale Cup winner. His father Gavin rode country cup winners, and he was brought up on ponies and horses from the age of three. He was breaking in ponies at the age of 11 or 12.
I read, and you tell the tale of your granddad, Len.
Yes. Len Rule, son of Jack. Len was a pretty decent bloke. It's a very sad story in a way. He was a motherless boy because their mother died in childbirth in the 1890s. And there's Len, my grandfather, and his big brother, who was Ernie, who was probably 16. Len was probably 13. And in 1904, they were at a place called Buxton up near Alexandra, and there was a New Year's Day race meeting run by the local pub, so you can imagine it was pretty rough and tough. It was on a pretty rough paddock. They'd probably stake a course out using flags. You know the story. And there'd be potholes and all the rest. And Ernie was a pretty handy rider, and he rode in three races. And I think in the fourth race, he rode in the hack race. He had a shocking fall, suffered terrible head injuries, and he didn't die immediately, but I understand that my grandfather, who was 13, accompanied him, his injured brother, in probably a bullock dray, I think, all the way over to Alexandra, which is a long way in those days. It was 20 kilometres or whatever, very slow in a dray when your brother's dying next to you. And he died that night in Alexandra, and he's buried at Alexandra. So it turns out that his name is on the monument at Caulfield of the 800-odd jockeys who have died in race falls.
Yeah, the fallen jockeys. So did Len pursue racing in any form then?
Not as much. He was always a good... He always loved the animal. He loved horses and dogs. He wasn't really a... He liked good thoroughbred horses, and he was had a great... He, in fact, bred a horse as an old, old man and broke it in, and then he died at the age of 79, and this colt he broke in went on to become champion stallion at Melbourne Royal, where Bill Roycroft put the champion ribbon on him, and he didn't live to see it happen, which was a great pity because he'd bred this big horse. He was by Laurentius, it was by Meadow Mist, I think. And he'd bred it out of an old bay mare that he bought in the stockyards at Bairnsdale, but he picked her out on type. And it turned out she was a good, well-bred, thoroughbred mare, we believe, who went back to sort of Comedy King and those that line. And she'd come out of the mountains at Omeo, where a lot of people bred good horses up there. It was what they did there. The Omeo people were always horse people. And he bred this colt and he fed him like a champion and broke him in himself, using all the long reins and all the rest of it. Didn't bother getting on him. He just drove him in reins and got him very quiet. And he turned out a slashing horse. He won that the big prize at Melbourne Royal, and then he stood at stud, siring stock horses and so on. But he was a thoroughbred horse, but never threw anything as good as himself, like many of them.
How true. They were amazing horsemen, weren't they, these people?
Well, he'd grown up... He was born in Len, born 1891. He was out working in the bush by the time he turned 9 or 10. He had a very hard life. He's brought up by relatives, a Dickensian life. It was shocking, really, what the life he led. Much like that... it's a book about a fortunate life by a fellow called A.B. Facey. My grandfather had a very similar life because he worked in the bush and on farms. He ran away from one place and almost drowned crossing a swamp where he was a very bad swimmer, and a big dog saved him. A dog jumped in the water and he grabbed hold of the dog and the dog pulled him to safety. He thought he was being pursued by his wicked uncle, or you know, uncle by marriage that he'd been working for who hadn't paid him. So he got hold of a pony and he used to plant the pony in the bush with a saddle on it so he could be ready to run away. So his life story was pretty interesting, but it always involved animals and particularly horses. And he told me, he told us not long before he died about was working up near Sale in the wheat country on, in those days they grew grain around Sale, they don't now. And he was working in the paddocks, you know, hoisting the big bags of wheat. And he had a girlfriend over at Stratford and he borrowed, this word borrow would be interesting, probably technically theft, he borrowed a horse from the paddock next door and he rode across country to Stratford, which is probably 8 or 10 miles. And then he crossed the Avon River on foot. It was very low at that stage. And he met the girl and talked to her and so on. And very much later, he went to cross back over the river to go back to where he came from. But there'd been a thunderstorm in the hills. And the river, the Avon River is one of the fastest running rivers in the world, like the Snowy. And it rose, you know, 6 feet or whatever. And he couldn't get back. Anyway, he got in the water and it swept him away. He's a bad swimmer. And it swept him and he thought, this is no good. I'll be drowned and no one will ever know where I am or what. Anyway, he was washed up on a point, but he was washed up on the wrong side. So he had to walk all the way back to Stratford, cross over at the bridge, walk all the way downriver to where his pony was planted, the horse, and then ride back to Sale. And he got back just in time to let the horse go and start work.
And he got away with it.
Got away with it. So there you go. Now, he was a practical horseman, loved the animal, went to World War One. Ended up driving vehicles with motors, but always loved the horses the most.
Yeah. And didn't think the motor was going to last, always went back to the horse?
Never loved them. Funny, isn't it? You know, in this generation, we find young people are so good with electronic, digital stuff, computers, and we don't really love it much. We think they're good tools, but we don't love them. My grandfather was like that, I know. with motors. He'd start a car and he'd rev the hell out of it because he was really a horseman deep down. And my father used to laugh at him and sort of thought he was sort of outdated. But he imbued in the rest of us that sort of love of the animal. And most of us have been inclined to like the animal and to, you know, like to breed one and fiddle around with them.
So Andrew, this filters down to you and your passion for it?
I think so. Another thing is I went off to boarding school in Sale. We lived up at Lake Tyres, which is well up, you know, between Bairnsdale and Orbost. So it's a long way from anywhere in those days. And at secondary school, I went down to Sale and I boarded there, but my parents couldn't really afford me to go to boarding school. So I went and lived with my uncle, Eric, or we call him Squib, who was my father's half-brother, the Stratford Rules, as we call them. And he had been a jockey as a young... they call him the Gippsland Munro because he rode a million winners in Gippsland. Started riding in races at 11. He rode so many winners before the age of 14 as an amateur that when he was given an apprenticeship at the age of 14, the chief steward at Sale said, "Son, how many winners did you ride before this?" And he said, "Oh, 60. And he said, "Well, you haven't got an allowance anymore." They took his £7 allowance off him. So he rode his whole apprenticeship without an allowance because he'd ridden so many winners as an amateur. And he was, you know, a very good country jockey in that era when there were a lot of good country jockeys. But he came to town. He rode at Flemington. He rode at Caulfield. He rode all around Victoria. And in fact, he told me that people would say to him, "Did you ever get anything out of racing?" He said, "Well, I rode in front of the Duke of Gloucester at Flemington and I thought I was going to win. but my horse faded in the straight and I ran fourth or something. But I met the Duke of Gloucester and he was a good jumps rider, rode over the jumps. And he rode it. He rode jumps winners, he rode flat winners, he rode pony races and the Squizzy Taylor tracks. And he rode at Melbourne Royal. He rode show horses. He could, you know, ride anything.
What about you? Did you actually win a picnic race as a jockey?
I did. I was just describing my uncle Squib Rule. I loved him. I was the executor of his will later. He was a lovely bloke, and I lived with him and his wife Auntie Kit, who was a lovely lady. And of course, their sons Gavin and John were jockeys. Gavin not for long. Very fine horseman, Gavin. His brother John was a very good jockey, but got big, got heavy, rode in a Grand National, I think in a 1 pound saddle. Good flat jockey, good jumps jockey, very game. Would often ride doubles and trebles in Gippsland. And when I grew up, you know, when I was a little kid, it was quite something to be his cousin in those days. And because I lived with Uncle Squib for 3 or 4 years in my teens, I used to go and ride work. Because they were always, you know, it's handy to have a kid to ride a bit of work. So I'd ride quiet horses work. And when the picnics came around, they gave me a few rides in the picnics for a couple of years. And I did ride one winner, which was at Swiss Creek, 1972, 4 furlongs. And I rode several other horses that day. I used to tend to run second or third because I wasn't much good at punching them out then, but... there were a lot of better riders than me at that stage. But I think had I stayed light, I would have learnt it.
They tell me you worked in the circus for a week.
A few days, yeah. I worked in the circus for a story for a magazine I was working for, Good Weekend magazine. I drove vehicles, fed the animals, you know, helped unpack it and set it up and all that. It was very interesting to work with those circus people and see how they handled animals and their philosophy. Very interesting people.
Racing Life, we're talking with Andrew Rule, one of our leading writers, particularly crime reporter here in Melbourne. We'll be back after this break for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Andrew Rule, my special guest this morning for Tobin Brothers Funerals. This is your Racing Life. We've spoken about your early days. What about involvement in horses now? Have you got an interest?
Yeah, I do have an interest. Over the years, in between, you know, writing books and raising children and all the paying the mortgage, my wife Di and I have had the odd interest in horses. We had one good horse years ago with Glenn Lester, You will recall that Glenn was a very fine racing writer.
The Gull?
The Gull. At the age, and I worked with Glenn. I always looked up to him as a really good racing writer, which he was. And he's a lovely fellow. And he said, I can buy this horse for $2,000. And we all said, what's the matter with it? And he said, there's nothing the matter with it. It's a two-year-old out in the paddock. But it had a backstory. It was out of a mare that had been sold off to a bigger stud. And that bigger stud did not want to sell in its draft of yearlings this horse by Raffendale because they stood other stallions. So they didn't want to be seen promoting an opposition stallion. So they hadn't sold it as a yearling. And there it was. It was 2 years old, unbroken, on an adjustment farm down at Lock, and all they wanted was the 2,000. Now, this is back in the 80s, so 2,000 was more than it is now. I got Uncle Squib, my uncle from Stratford, to drive down to Lock and have a look at it. He said, nothing wrong with him, get him. So Glenn bought him, Glenn paid the money, and he leased him to a group of us, Jim Tennyson, you might recall, the journalist, and several of us. And this big grey horse by Raffendale, and Adam and Agricola mare, and he was called Captain Palace, which Glenn had picked that name from a headstone down on the Great Ocean Road, some old
colours of black and white stripes.
I think it was. I think
Pengilly or
Jack Pengilly. Jack Pengilly. Jack Pengilly, son of a very fine trainer back in the 20s.
Yep.
Jack was a lovely man. He and his brother Digger and his sister all lived together down at Epsom. Or near Epsom, and they had this lovely... And they only ever trained two or three horses at a time. And he trained him. And that horse, he won four at Sandown. He won down the straight six. He won at Ballarat. He won races from the age of three until the age of nine, I think. And Glenn was offered the price, at that time, the price of a house. I think he was offered 80,000 set to send him to Hong Kong or somewhere. And my house in Kensington, we sold for 74,000 around that era. So that shows you he knocked back the money because he wanted to keep him in Australia and raise him. And he gave us a lot of pleasure. And basically, you know, he paid for himself all the way through. And when we wound him up, we all had a few hundred bucks left. But he was a cracker. I think he won his first race in town at by six lengths or something. He was at 33-1. I didn't have enough on him. I'm not really a punter.
We never do.
I'm not a punter.
And Andrew, so you've got the interest now.
I do. Look, over the years I've had a few others, the odd one. I've even bred one or two slow ones. But currently we have a little filly. A group of us have a filly called Answered Prayers. She's by Wanted from a Hassanay mare. She's a little bulldog, and she's been trained by Catherine Durden and Craig Durden down at Moriac. Does fast work at Geelong. There's a group of us, of friends who are involved, and we called her Answered Prayers because she's by Wanted out of this mare, untainted. And we've called her that because our little grandson, Gus, who's asleep upstairs here, was born very premature and had a tough time surviving his first few weeks. And I said, if he goes all right and survives and shows a bit of fighting spirit, I'll buy this filly and syndicate her and we'll call it Answered Prayers. And that's exactly the story. So Gus is going well and so's the filly. And they're both, they've got big hearts.
That's beautiful. And where's the filly at the moment? How far away?
We had a broken in, very good broker down near Geelong, Ocean Grove Way. Broke her in, turned her out, worked her up again, pre-trained her. We really got her educated beautifully. Because I know young horses, I think, need every advantage, and education is a key with them, I think. And she's gone off to Catherine Durden, who has taken her along very steady. She's trialled her at Geelong and at Camperdown. Both times showed a lot of fight. Both times she made ground on the winner of the trial and railed up like a greyhound. So she's a little racehorse. She's honest. She's got a bit of ability. We don't know how much ability, but the signs are good. She's not a squib, to coin a phrase. Not that my uncle Squib was a squib. he was called Squib because he was small, not because he lacked heart.
Tell me, 40 years in newspaper, where do you see racing's appeal now? We pick up the paper, the morning paper, and gee whiz, we've pushed, the racing stories are pushed further and further back. It's losing ground.
It does. It worries me, and I've felt for 20 years that racing needs to broaden its base. I think it's basically incestuous. It relies really on those people who are already in the business, plus the odd, what I would call an injection here and there of mug money. You know, somebody makes a lot of dough somewhere, without mentioning names, we can all think of them, such as possibly Nathan Tinkler. You know, but they turn up, they go to the yearling sales, they spend a lot of dough and they sort of float the boat for a while. That's fine, but I don't think ultimately it's sustainable, because in the end those sort of people get burnt, they spend too much, and then they give it away. And then they've got to find somebody else to come in and fill the bill. What racing really needs is that grassroots interest level, the way that our other sports, you know, football is really popular for all sorts of reasons, but one of the reasons is thousands and thousands of people play it at a junior level and understand it and love it and follow it up through the thing. Racing doesn't really have that grassroots base the way it had when my grandfather was around. Because in the old days, people understood horses and were familiar with them and it was part of life. It's not like that now, obviously. But so what did we do about it? Well, I think it's got to broaden out its interest base and not homogenise the product. We basically have got horses, you know, they're all bred to run 1,200 to 14 to a mile, you know. They're the same bunch of riders running the same bunch of horses over the same distances, which is why it needs more variety. I think Moonee Valley bringing in that sprint series is smart. I think, personally, if I could wave a wand, I would have both long-distance races, like this three-mile race that's coming up at Warrnambool, the Jericho Cup.
Fantastic idea.
Fantastic idea. I think that's interesting, and that'll put racing back in the front pages, because it's not strictly racing. It's all about the Anzacs, and it's about loss and about patriotism and all sorts of things. It's about marathon running horses.
Heroes.
It creates an interest level. The other end of the scale, why haven't we got, mad sprinters? Where's the outlet for the 4 furlong horse, as we used to say, the 800 metres? Why don't we have a cannonball series for those mad sprinters that create their own velocity? We all know that when we go to the Olympics, and I went to the London Olympics and I've followed them all my life, that the premier event is the men's 100 yards. Well, that animal is the, in thoroughbred terms, is the horse that'll go hard for 800 metres, 850 metres, 900 metres. Why don't we have some of those events in Victoria and sort of spread the net a bit? Why don't we have a pony race series like they have in Ireland and England? They have these in Ireland. This is where their good riders come from.
That's right.
Ireland produces more good jockeys per head than any country in the world, probably. And they come out of the pony racing circuit, which is a seriously good circuit. And they've got a market for them. They have champion ponies that are worth a lot of money. And if we had each district in Victoria or Australia with its own pony race circuit tacked onto the major race meetings, it would create more interest. You'd have, jockeys under the age of 16.
Getting down to the junior ranks.
Junior ranks. Mm. And you'd have ponies that's running over certain heights for short distances. And, of course, the grand final would be on Spring Carnival or whatever. You'd have it, the grand final of these, the championship. Mm. And that would create more interest in the front, in the news, mainstream news, than Emirates Stakes would. I mean, that's the truth. Because somebody says, can the little freckled kid from Mildura beat the little kid from Gippsland, or will they all be wiped out by, Darren Weir's foreman's niece from Warrnambool?
The image of racing in Victoria over the last couple of years has been bashed about a bit.
It has, and I'm sure the cumulative effect is not good. I think that the danger is the big corporate sponsors who are, A, don't really understand racing that much and don't necessarily love it, that they could easily shy away from pouring millions into racing when all they see in the papers is cobalt, jiggers, whatever it might be, the latest scandal. You know, the Les Samba thing, we all know the scandals. And, of course, there always is some scandal somewhere. But in the end, and I've been saying this to people recently, I've got an idea for an international bloodstock book, and I've been saying to people, racing needs heroes. Racing needs poetry. Racing needs the beautiful things promoted about it, because the only good journalism I've read about racing, or the best journalism in the world about racing in the last 15 years, has been to its detriment. The biggest story about racing in America since the year 2000 has been a savage expose of what's wrong with it. That is about injuries, drugs, all the rest of it in America. New York Times did it. Now, what racing needs is for good journalists to be doing the good side of racing. And this, to get back to your point, until that happens, or, you know, if that doesn't happen, I think the big sponsors are gradually going to say, well, why are we pouring millions into this when we could pour it into something else?
Well, you look at the VRC. Now, Emirates is going to walk away from the Melbourne Cup. Crown are walking away from the Oaks. They're two plum sponsors.
I would have thought so. These are big names. And I noticed there's a sponsorship job, a management job going with the VRC. No wonder. It's obviously a big problem, and it's going to be somebody to fill that gap. And I hope it's not hard to fill, obviously. But you'd think those sort of sponsors don't grow on trees. And racing needs, as I say, the beauty and the poetry, the tradition. It needs all those things emphasised.
There's so much romance in it, isn't there?
There is.
If you want to cut it back, there is so much romance.
It is. It is a romantic pastime. And in the end, that's all it is. Its importance is that it's not important. Its importance is the romantic aspect. If I can get a little filly and call it Answered Prayers and pray that she wins a race, it's not a logical thing to do. There's no common sense in it. It's not an investment, is it, Brian? It's merely a way for me to waste some money on a beautiful thing, as long as I think it's beautiful. The minute I think it's not beautiful, the minute I think it stinks, or it's not worth it, or there's something unpleasant about it, I won't do it. And I think that's that delicate balance that racing has.
That's very true, and it's about the journey that you enjoy or experience with your people, with your friends, as you're, you know, the journey that you're embarking on now with this filly. Who knows where it may go?
That's right. I mean, you've had that journey with Fields of Omar. It's a journey that at some level a lot of different owners can have at a not at no stratospheric levels. Even to, you know, to win a maiden first up at somewhere would be a good start. But it's sort of the sense of shared. I'm sure you'd know this with syndicates. That sense of, I think a big syndicate's probably a better one, better than a small syndicate. You know, that if 50 people can enjoy it, it's probably better than two people enjoying it.
Well, that's how we enjoy our racing. We have 150 people in five horses with 10%, and it's good because it gives everyone a connection, and you're all there for the same common denominator.
It's a cracker, and I think obviously that's the future of racing is getting people involved at that level. The other thing is perhaps a sense of teams, and I don't know how you do this, but the sort of loyalty that people have for their football club, so if that can somehow be transferred into racing terms, I'm not sure how that is. Maybe it's going to come down to stables, big stables with their own colours, and syndicates sort of going, well, we're Hayes people, you know, we love Hayes, and so and so says no, we're with Weary. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know, there's only a few now. There might be a few less soon. Maybe that's one way it could go. However, what we've got to be careful to do is not cut off that grassroots connection, because where does the interest come from once you kill those? I mean, I think harness racing, personally, has sort of got pushed to the margins for all sorts of reasons, and we won't go into them here. But the fact that harness racing went from the centre of town out to Melton, to me, means it means I'll never go there. Here's me. I could be marginally interested in it. I have relatives who are interested in it, but you won't catch me going to Melton to see it. You might have caught me going to Moonee Valley or the showgrounds. It seems to me that the racing industries, the equine industries, lost a massive opportunity by not redeveloping the showgrounds as an equine centre of excellence rather than as some sort of half-baked, you know, exhibition hall and supermarket.
That's very true. Andrew Rule is my guest this morning. This is Your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. My guest this morning is Andrew Rule, celebrated journalist, a winner of the Graham Perkin Award, the Golden Quill Award. Gee, you've topped the pops a few times, haven't you?
Yeah, had a bit of luck in running here and there. I'm probably not the Brazilian rider. I'm not Moreira, but I'd try to be Hugh Bowman.
Andrew, when we read Andrew Rule, naturally we think of Underbelly. What an amazing series.
It was. Of course, the credit goes to my very good friend John Sylvester, who thought of the name word Underbelly. John and I were, you know, battling journos with kids and mortgages, and I did a book once, and he said, that's a good idea, why don't we do something together? So we put out different books together, and what we'd do is stitch together our own crime stories from the newspapers into books, and he said, what will we call this thing? And he thought of it, the word Underbelly, and so we produced these books, and a lot of people approached us thinking that there was a chance to do something for television. We had several approaches. Most consistently, it was from Channel 9 because of Eddie Maguire, the then young Eddie, who worked in Melbourne, you know, at that time. He'd organised meetings with the Sydney end of Channel 9, and we'd talk to them about this. And Eddie would push it, and it wouldn't quite get up. They'd say, oh, no, it won't appeal to women, and it's a bit too dark, and, you know, all this stuff. And I have to give credit where it's due. The very week that Eddie took over as the chief of Channel 9 in Sydney, that time when he went to Sydney, the first week he took over, he said, there's a thing called Underbelly. Here's the proposal. And he gave it to the head of drama. And she rang me up and said, Eddie wants a thing called Underbelly. Can I come down and see you and John? And she came down and saw us. And away it went from there. So Eddie had always been the champion of it, of the idea. He suggested it. He made it happen. And indeed, as soon as a good production house got hold of it and made that first series, away it went. I think the first series was terrific. I think it's still, you could still watch it. I think it progressively went downhill. You know, I think the second one wasn't as good as the first. The third one certainly wasn't as good. And then they had legal troubles, so they started to do ancient history, and, you know, it became faintly ridiculous towards the end. They're doing Squizzy Taylor and all sorts of things.
Did you envisage that it could be as successful as it was?
A confluence of events. There was the Underworld War happened, which was transfixed not just Victoria but Australia. This picked up on that whole Underworld War at a time when people were just fascinated by it. And the second thing was the people making it were headstrong. They were from Sydney and they knew better, and they wouldn't take any advice about what was going to be legally dicey and what wasn't. And they insisted on making something that a judge insisted on banning, not to be shown in Victoria because of various court cases that were happening. So, of course, the ban made it irresistible. So the series, the TV series, the drama series was banned in Victoria, which meant people were going up into New South Wales and buying it. People were selling bootleg copies on building sites.
You can't buy that publicity.
And we had hundreds of thousands of books for sale, which they could buy, because the book wasn't banned. So the ban on the TV series sold a lot of books. So you just, you know, they can't teach that sort of stuff at the Harvard MBA course. It's just luck.
Would you do it again?
Something came along. Yeah, we look at various ideas here and there, but it's a bit like, you know, I always quote that Farlap thing. You know, the man that bought Farlap for, you know, he bought him on a pedigree theory, which worked, but he really fluked Farlap. And after that, he said, no problem. And he went out and he bought 40 yearlings or something, 38 yearlings or whatever. And I think only, you know, only two of them won their maiden or something. It didn't work. I think you shouldn't mistake one huge success as a predicator of future successes. One big success doesn't mean you're a genius. It means you were lucky once.
When we look at that series, we see the name Mockbell surface, Mr. Mockbell, and he loved his racing.
He did. He was a very keen punter.
Well-informed.
He was well-informed, although even those sort of blokes with a lot of money and very well-informed and extremely friendly with some jockeys, not all, couldn't always make the results turn out the way he wanted. Mind you, it didn't matter to those guys. I mean, they were money launderers in the end. And basically, they didn't get, if they invested 100 grand to get back 80, that's, they were happy. They were just washing it. There is a story that I heard from a fellow in Sydney who was a reasonably astute fellow, but he didn't know who this Tony from Melbourne was. And a trainer who shall remain nameless, a former jockey, said, listen, mate, he said to my friend, he said, I want you to come up and look at some horses in the Hunter Valley with Tony from Melbourne. We'll pick him up and we'll take him up and look at these yearlings. And my fella says, yep. So they hop in the car together, they drive up to the Hunter to look at the yearlings. And on the way, this fella, Tony, who's very friendly and very good talker and a lot of funny stories, he tells the story of a jumps race in Melbourne that he had bagged. He had every jockey in the bag except one, the one on the 50-1 shot. And he thought, well, he can't win, but I've got all the others organised. And he bet accordingly, but you know what happened? The 50-1 shot got up. The one jockey didn't have in the bag. And he told this story against himself, and that was Tony Mockbell. Tony from Melbourne was Tony Mockbell. He had, you know, he had 11 jockeys out of 12 in the bag, but he didn't have the 50-1 shot, and it won. So he laughed and laughed because he thought, well, you can spend all that time and money setting something up and it still goes astray, which is the beauty of racing.
In your time writing about these people, how close do you get to them?
Oh, I don't. I'm not.
They've got to be confident with you, though, don't they?
Yeah. Look, I'm not friendly with... The one person I knew well... Well, and John and I knew well, was Mark Chopper Reed, because we published his books, we rewrote them, we edited them, we published them, we, you know, we did everything. So by necessity, we knew him well, and we ended up not on good terms with him towards the end. Not really, it was more to do with the people around him. That was, you know, his wives and managers and things. But we always got on well with him, and he was a very funny man. Obviously, a very flawed and strange individual, but he was funny and he was intelligent, strange to say. A complete failure as a criminal. Was never really the bloke that stole your video or stole your car, or he wasn't that. He was somebody who, had he gone into the army at 17, which he tried to do, but was rejected because he had flat feet, would have made a very fine soldier, very fine SAS soldier or something. But was, as I say, was sort of couldn't do that, and ended up being a sort of a soldier in the underworld, where basically he stood over other crooks and took money from them and lived that life, which is a very dangerous and nasty life. And he was lucky to die of natural causes rather than die of the many bullets and knives and things that have been aimed his way.
When we look back at the gangland murders, how is history going to record that?
There's been some big criminal outbreaks in this country. There's, of course, the Bushranger era, and of course Ned Kelly's the most famous one. But there's, you know, Ben Hall, there was Frank Gardner and those guys. So they're all the big Bushranger stories. Then we had the '20s. We had the whole Squizzy Taylor era and the razor gangs and so on. We had the 50s, 60s, Freddie the Frog Harrison and all the painters and dockers. People forget that there was a massive painter and docker war in the 60s and 70s where a lot of people died, but the bodies disappeared and then nobody said anything. So it is said that the late Billy Longley was the last to see, you know, 15
Texan?
People. The Texan. Yeah. Last to see 15 people alive, they say. That, you know, who knows? But there was a lot of that going on. So the gangland war, in that context, it was a part of a continuum of crime. But it happened in the an era when there was more publicity. It happened in an era when, you know, people were filming other people, so there was a record of it. And it, and the television drama actually brought these characters out into the open. It sort of made them household names. I mean, no one except people involved in certain, in Two Up and all different things like that, would have known Mick Gatto 20 years ago. He was around. He, you know, some of us had heard of him, but he wasn't a public figure. It was the television show that made him a public figure. And so on. You know, the same with Carl Williams, the same with Venom and all these guys. They were just unknown people. And some of them were very, very unknown people. They were nobodies, really. But the TV thing and the books with it and that spawned media coverage and so on and so on, they've become sort of public figures, and therefore they live on in our collective memory. And the word underbelly summons up that whole thing. People are now calling it the underbelly war. I mean, it's just a word, but it's caught the imagination.
Why has the general public got this insatiable sort of appetite for it?
I think it's human nature. To some extent, when you think about it, a lot of the great drama and even literature is based on, in some sense, on crime. What's Macbeth? Yeah. What's most of the show, you know? The Merchant of Venice is about a bloke who wanted his pound of flesh. He wanted the money back, and when he couldn't get it, he cut a pound of flesh off with a knife. I mean, this is straight from the Mafia Handbook, isn't it? Yeah. You know, so I think life and death and goodness, good versus evil, is the basis of most of our most fascinating dramas and stories at every level, from opera to the lowest level. And I don't see it as unusual. I just see it as a different version of the same thing.
At the moment, we're going through a spate of carjacking and home invasion, and you were pretty close to something like that.
Yeah, just had a bit of a brush with it on the Geelong Road of about 4 weeks ago. My wife and I are driving back at night. We look in the rear vision and see a blue and red light shining, like a police undercover car has on its dash, that sort. The small lights. It followed us for a while. I was doing exactly the speed limit. They didn't use a siren at all, which is unusual. But anyway, I pulled over. I thought, well, it's police, I'll pull over. I put the window down. I didn't get out because these days I don't think it's smart to get out because the police might think you're a threat to them. So I just put the window down. A fellow approaches my car. He's not a policeman in uniform. He's a rough-looking young fella wearing a high-vis wind cheater, the sort they wear on building sites. And his first words are not... He didn't just pull out a wallet and show me his warrant card to show that he was an undercover policeman or a plainclothes policeman. He said something silly like, "Oh, mate, do you live around here?" And I thought, this is clearly just bogus, just a bogus thing. I mean, he's pulled me up with fake police lights, and then he's trying to strike up a conversation in order, in my view, to get close up to the window. And I just put the car in a gear and took off because I realised he was going to pull a stunt of some sort. I was driving a pretty good German car of the sort that are often stolen. And I have heard of other incidents on that road, one involving a person I know who's a senior legal person in an Audi sedan, and another one was well publicised, was a former senior policeman, Noel Ashby, in a late model Mercedes. He was surrounded by some young blokes with a tomahawk, they were trying to pull him over, and he just outdrove them. He just put the foot down and drove away. But the lesson here is, at night, if you have any doubts about the true identity of somebody pretending to be that could or could not, might or might not be police, if you've got doubts, drive away and go to a service station or somewhere public.
Can you believe this is happening in Victoria?
5 years ago, we would not have been having this conversation. 3 years ago, I don't think we'd be having this conversation. This has now become a staple subject in Melbourne. The fact that we're on a racing program now talking about it tells you something. You couldn't have dreamed of talking about this stuff not long ago. It's out of Detroit, it's out of Miami, it's out of Johannesburg.
Thanks for your time. We got off the track a little bit, but it's been good just to sort of listen to your story. And I love the roots of racing around the Gippsland area from Grandpa Len and what they did and the tough times they came through. But they're great survivors.
They were. I'd like to dedicate this the memory of all those old dead rules. Len, my Uncle Squib, his son John, who has left us. John Rule was the really good rider. And the initials J. Rule still appear in the race book here and there with young Jacob, who's John's nephew and Gavin's son. So the name lives on. And all I hope is that I could put J. Rule on answered prayers at a racetrack sometime soon.
Well, that's one we're going to be cheering for, answered prayers. Good on you. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.